The stock market is trading at new record highs today after closing yesterday at a record. President Trump has been tweeting about the market, which is up almost 20% since the election. We're joined now by Ali Velshi, MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent and co-host of Velshi and Rule. Hi, Ali.
Hello there, Jeremy.
So the Dow is trading near 22,000 today. The S&P 500 and the NASDAQ reached record highs in July. We're going to get to the politics in a moment, but first, what is driving this?
Well, the markets are up almost about 9% through the first 7 months of Donald Trump's term, and I always use the S&P 500 because it's broader and it reflects people's holdings a little bit better. But a couple of things happened. One is the market was on an upturn and has been for the last couple of years, and number two is when Donald Trump came in, there was a surge ahead in certain types of stocks, infrastructure stocks, banking stocks, financials, things like that, that are set to do better under Donald Trump. Now, even though he hasn't succeeded in removing a lot of regulations, a lot of these companies and their investors understand that under the Donald Trump administration, there's less likely to be new regulations and things like that. So these companies continue to surge ahead. In fairness, many of them are actually doing well on earnings. In other words, it's not just a sentiment thing. It's that their earnings are up, so the stock prices are up.
Well, and there are several people in the White House right now who came from Goldman Sachs. So I assume Wall Street feels like they're going to be treated pretty well.
That's correct. That's exactly right. It's a comfortable, it's a better place to be for certain types of companies than it was under the Obama administration, which constantly enacted and or threatened greater regulation of certain industries.
But worth pointing out that the stock market is just one economic indicator. Does it really signal strength in the overall economy?
It's a good question. Less so than when I started in this business 20-some years ago. Even 15 years ago or 10 years ago, there was a closer tie between the performance of the stock market and the economy in general. The problem now and since the recession is that fewer people own stocks. In fact, about 80% of all stocks are owned by sort of the top 20% of the earners in this country. So most Americans, about half of all Americans, own no stock at all. And of the half that do, many are passive investors through their 401k. So the bottom line is the stock market being up does not benefit as many people as it once did.
Are there fears that this could be it, that we're sitting here talking about new record highs and one day soon things are going to start to move in the other direction?
Yeah, I'm actually going to have a conversation this afternoon with Bob Shiller, the Yale economist who has his own way of measuring whether stocks are in line with their earnings. And according to his index, the last time it was this high was in 2000 before the dot-com bubble burst. And before that, it was 1929 before the Great Depression. So there's widespread fear that the market won't continue its upward trajectory. That doesn't mean it's going to crash. That doesn't mean that it's even going to be in a correction. It just means we might not continue to see this kind of ride. Goldman Sachs itself has said that market returns are likely to be lower over the next decade because we've had such a fast run-up.
Now, President Trump has been taking credit for the market bounce. It is worth noting, though, that the Dow tripled under President Obama, which is something that President Trump never mentioned and never mentions.
Right.
How much credit goes to the president?
So my general view is that presidents get all too much benefit and too much blame for a lot of these things. They're just not as closely tied to it as one would think. But generally speaking, there's quite a lag between what an administration does and what the results are. So it's whatever you see now is not all that likely to be due to President Trump, except for the fact that the banks and the infrastructure companies went up entirely on expectations that the Trump administration would be friendlier to those sorts of stocks. Now, President Obama saw, so we've been up about 9% in the first 7 months of this term. The first 7 months of Obama's term, markets were up 23%, but that was coming off of the bottom of the recession. So, you know, there are different reasons for all of these things. Bottom line is, I'd be careful if I were any president about taking too much responsibility for it. Sometimes, you know, in the case of Bill Clinton, he was benefiting from policy that went into place before he came in and this remarkable surge in the economy. So I don't know how much they have to do with presidents or not. Presidents can certainly help and hurt, but I don't know that they can claim full responsibility.
Is the market still expecting tax reform to go through in Congress?
sort of, kind of. This market seems to be somewhat divorced from this dysfunction in Congress and in the White House. The only time this market shudders is when things come up that look like they could be constitutional crises. So when the stuff between Jeff Sessions and Donald Trump looked serious, the market sort of paused a little bit. If government is going to continue to function and there isn't going to be war and things like that, this market doesn't seem to care about the politics of it one bit. Tax reform is going to be hard to do without having passed health care, because a lot of the savings that the administration wanted to use for tax cuts was going to come from cutting spending in the health care bill. So that's going to be harder.
That's Ali Velshi, MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent. We'll keep an eye on the markets. Ali, thank you.
My pleasure.
To Turkey now, where nearly 500 people were paraded through court in a trial today, accused in connection with last summer's attempt to topple President Recep Tayyip Erdogan. Handcuffed defendants were jeered as they were escorted into court by armed guards in front of TV cameras. But the main defendant lives in Pennsylvania. President Erdogan says the U.S.-based cleric Fethullah Gulen is behind attempts to overthrow him and has been calling on the U.S. to extradite Gulen. But meanwhile, he's being tried in absentia. Emre Temel is with the BBC Turkish service following the trial from London. Emre, this sounds like an extraordinary day in court. What are the specific charges against these defendants? Nearly 500.
Yeah, it's really extraordinary, Robin, because it is the biggest trial regarding the last year's coup attempt in Turkey yet. And the actual number is 461 of the suspects in the case are being tried in jail, and there are seven fugitives. And 18 of them are being tried without arrest. You ask me the specific charges. To be honest, the list is very long. I will count only a few of them. They are being accused of violating the constitution, attempting to assassinate the president, attempting to abolish the government of Turkey, managing an armed terrorist organization, manslaughter, and deprivation of liberty are a few of them. Robert.
What were the manslaughter charges? Remind us.
This is really important because obviously this is a trial about the Akinci Air Base, which is close to capital Ankara. Some warplanes took off from this air base last year, and these airplanes were used to bomb the Turkish parliament. That's why manslaughter is one of the charges.
Yeah. And are the defendants members of the military who participated in the coup? Are the people that we saw, you know, just average citizens who came out to the streets? Who are they?
The most well-known defender is a former Air Force commander. But there are some civilians as well. And all these civilian leaders are being accused of acting as a part of FETÖ, which we call in Turkey Fethullahist terrorist organization called by the Turkish government. By the way, we need to remind our audience as well that Mr. Gulen rejects all the charges.
Right. How much support does President Erdogan have in this trial? We're reminded that there was a vote recently that would give him more power. He won that vote. But what's the sense of whether or not people really support him in this trial? Is it evenly split? What's the sense there?
First of all, I need to say that all political parties, including the opposition parties, were against the coup attempt last year. However, we are talking about a country which is still deeply divided and polarized after 18 months from the coup attempt. And the leader of the Turkey's main opposition party, Kemal Kılıçdaroğlu, completed a 25-day march for justice from the capital Ankara to Istanbul last month. And he basically said, "We vote for the non-existent justice in Turkey." Opposition in Turkey believes that there is no rule of law in Turkey anymore. But on the other hand, the government says Turkey's justice system works very well. But country is still 50-50. Please remind the constitutional referendum which took place in Turkey in mid-April. Yes vote won it by almost 52%, but opposition didn't accept the result. That's why I think this division among the Turkish society reflects the perception about the existence of justice in Turkey as well.
Emre, what's expected to come from this trial? Will we see 461 or so people convicted and trotted away to prison? There's no death penalty in the country, but prisons are horrific. Or what? What's expected?
All suspects will be on trial until the August 28th for the first hearings. However, we don't expect any verdict soon because the prosecutor's indictment is over 6,000 pages long. And the prosecutors are demanding 330 life sentences for the 45 of the suspects. You mentioned the death penalty. Yes, Turkey abolished the death penalty as a part of EU reforms. However, President Erdogan raised this issue a few times, and he basically said, if Turkish parliament will vote for it, I would sign him immediately. I am not saying death penalty will be brought back to Turkey soon, but I think President Erdogan doesn't rule out this option.
Emre Temel with the BBC's Turkish service in London. Emre, thank you so much.
You're welcome, Robin.
It's been more than a year since the death of 20-year-old Rahil Siddiqui focused a spotlight on charges of hazing in the Marines. Siddiqui was at boot camp at Parris Island, South Carolina, for just 11 days when he leapt three stories to his death, according to those there. An autopsy ruled the death a suicide, but there were questions and allegations. Siddiqui, a Muslim, was reportedly called a terrorist by his drill instructors, subjected to severe violence. At times, he said he wanted to kill himself. The military said he was at low risk of harm. But the Marines also investigated his death for over a year, launched two additional investigations into systematic hazing. 20 Marines have been relieved of duty and face punishment. That includes Battalion Commander Lieutenant Colonel Joshua Kassoon, who will face court-martial for failure to obey a lawful general order. He's accused of failing to remove a senior drill instructor who was implicated in recruit abuse. Rahil Siddiqui's family has given few interviews, but they join us today. They say they have something to say. Masoud Siddiqui, his father, is here. Welcome. How are you?
Fine, thank you. Yourself?
I'm just fine. Ghazala, his mom. Hi, Ghazala.
Hi, how are you?
Good. Sidra Siddiqui is Rahil's sister. Hi, Sidra.
Hi.
And the family's lawyer, Shiraz Khan, joins them as well. Hi, Shiraz.
Thank you for having us.
So the whole Siddiqui family is here with their lawyer. And we know that you all want to say something about where we are in time and your son's, your brother's death. So, Ghazala, let's start with you. What would you want people to know?
I want to know everybody to know that my son is a very good son. He was a very good son, very respectful, very responsible.
He was an incredible student, wasn't he? He was very bright.
Yes. He very intelligent, smart student, valedictorian student, top 10. And he never killed himself.
He would never have killed himself, is that what you're saying?
Yes. Yeah. He was mentally and physically ready to go. There is no reason for him.
Masoud, Rahil's dad?
I want to say that Rahil, before go to the Marines, Rahil prepared very sincerely. He understand everything, what need to be done, you know, get into the suicide or something.
Yeah.
I don't believe that because I am 100% sure he was very strong, very intelligent. He prepared something wrong happened over there.
Sidra, it's sounding from having spoken with all of you that your family doesn't believe that this was suicide. Your family believes something else happened. Now, we know from accounts, and they are terrible, and I hope you don't mind if I repeat some of them, that Rahil could barely speak this day. His platoon mates said that this was torture, what was happening to them, beyond the, we know, very tough Marine training, that he couldn't speak, that actually blood had come out of his throat, that he was on the floor clutching his throat when a drill instructor slapped him a couple of times. A platoon mate said it was so hard it echoed across the squad bay.
Yes.
And then your brother got up and started dead sprinting. The platoon mates thought he was running away from the abuse, but it dawned on him that your brother was going to jump, and he did. Three stories. These are witnesses who said he ran and jumped. Are you saying that you don't think it was suicide, that you think it was just a crazed attempt to get away from the abuse? Or what?
We know it wasn't suicide. My brother, it wasn't in his character to do something like that. While my brother was being recruited by the Marines, they made him believe that he had a golden chance to do anything that he wanted to prosper in life. Like, he went to college to be an engineer, but when the Marines came, they made him believe that, you know, they gave him this golden chance. And everything that we were told what they did to him, and I think it was really wrong. And he was a very strong person, very determined. I know that he didn't kill himself.
But he did say he was suicidal a couple of times. He went
well,
through
he
the
said
process.
That because he knew that if you say that they let you go back home,
and also
he wasn't actually going to do it.
He also recanted it and went back. He said, "Okay, I can handle this," and went back. I want to bring in your family's lawyer, Shiraz Khan. What is it that you want people to know that you feel isn't being told?
Many things. One, I want to start with, Rahil wasn't weak. He was not a quitter. He was not unprepared for this. He wasn't a liar. He was an American who happened to be a Muslim. And Rahil was a target before he even left Michigan.
Well, this gets to the heart of one of the biggest questions around this. Do you think that he was singled out, as we're hearing other recruits were singled out, for special horrendous treatment because he was Muslim?
Absolutely.
Yes.
All the accounts, all the facts, everything that's come out clearly show that there was a bias against Muslims there. And that creates a problem because this is not a Muslim issue. This is an American issue. This was an American who died on American soil.
I want to ask Dad, Masood.
Yes.
How horrific. According to reports, when your son's body was returned, you and the family thought what? I mean, because of the bruises on his body.
When I see the body, it has too much torture. Something happened. That's what it looks
whole
like.
Whole body is damaged. Whole body damage.
Yeah.
Because according to the body, when I see he not jump like by himself and have this kind of damage to the body.
The injuries are inconsistent with the fall. Mm-hmm. There's injury to the body, both internal and external, for which they have no explanation.
Well, it sounds like Sidra, the sister of Rahil, it sounds like you think he was killed.
He was killed. I know he didn't commit suicide, and I want those people to pay for it. The main people who are the reason of my brother not being here, I believe they should pay with their life, and everyone else that was involved, they should be charged and go to jail.
Not just for behavior unbecoming to an officer. I'm thinking of some of the other charges that are against the commanding officers.
They're insufficient. The charges are insufficient at best. Realistically, there is more than enough evidence here to bring assault at the very least as a charge. That's in the USMC report, and that's backed up by the evidence on the body. That's backed up by the statements.
Yeah.
But it's very clear to us now that that's not the direction they want this to go.
Well, and you would say what, Shiraz Khan, the lawyer, to those who might say, look, people have died in Marine training. It's really tough. You're mm-hmm. saying, no, this isn't that. This is what, pushing somebody too far, being too abusive, targeting them?
What I'm saying is that suicide is not the only way that people die in the military. The evidence, the facts, the statements, the report, the findings all lead to and all clearly show that all of that led to his death.
Meantime, Ghazala, mom of Rahil Siddiqui, do I understand you keep his room with all of his accomplishments, a terrific student, really an aspiring engineer, and his pressed uniform? You keep that?
I have all certificate and uniform, everything, and badge, everything I have.
I wonder, some would say, after your experience, what you think happened in the military and what most accounts say, at the very least, Rahil was targeted for being Muslim and he was abused. I'm surprised you want that uniform there.
We want that uniform there because that's what my brother wanted to do. Like I said before, he wanted that title and he wanted to serve this country. He wanted to be a Marine.
But now I realize maybe my son do big mistake. Why he trusts the people? Why they go over there? Now I realize because I lose everything now. Only my son, only one son. What can I do now? He mm-hmm. trusts. I trust this country. This why I send, I give permission. I told go before my son, don't go, son. He said, don't worry, mom. The people only give training, 3 month training, I come back. Now I'm thinking He do mistake, big mistake.
It's a terrible, terrible question. But I know there are people thinking it. That this is, as sad as this is, these are the Marines. And, you know, not everybody is cut out for the Marines. And, you know, my dad was a Marine and it crushed him. So what do you say to the people who say he should have stuck with schooling and engineering? He wasn't cut out for the Marines.
I don't care what people say and I don't care what people think. I want justice for my family and for my brother. That's what I want.
We've sent out our questions, our requests for evidence. We've sent all that out to the Marines, to the coroner, to the pathologist. The problem here is that at this time, the Marine Corps has only given to us 20 out of about 240, you know, pieces of evidence. I mean, evidence that they say supports their claim, they're holding on to it. And see, that creates a problem because if you want to make a claim, you better have the evidence to back it up.
That's the family of Rahil Siddiqui, Masood, his dad, Ghazala, his mom, Sidra, his sister, along with the family's lawyer, Shiraz Khan. I want to thank you all. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Well, we reached out to the Marines. They said they're standing by the results of the official autopsy result of suicide from the South Carolina coroner, and the Marine Corps condolences continue to be with the family during this difficult time. The family's lawyer, Shiraz Khan, says they are considering legal action.
A lawsuit filed today makes serious allegations against both the Fox News Channel and Ed Butowski, a Fox News commentator and wealthy Trump supporter. The lawsuit, filed by paid Fox News commentator Rod Wheeler, claims that the news channel propelled a false story about Democratic National Committee aide Seth Rich, who was murdered last summer, and that the White House knew about it. NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik broke the story and joins us now. David, this is a complicated story, but lay out exactly what this lawsuit alleges.
Well, this lawsuit alleges that from the outset, Wheeler was hired by Ed Butowski, an investor in Dallas, seemingly as a good Samaritan to investigate the unsolved murder of Seth Rich on behalf of his parents. And in fact, according to the lawsuit and Rod Wheeler, from the outset, Ed Butowski had a different aim in mind, and that is that proving that somehow Seth Rich was behind the leak of thousands and thousands of emails among Democratic Party officials and their allies last year, the disclosure of which during the presidential campaign threw Hillary Clinton's bid really off kilter for a while there. And this was this was pursued by Butowski and in partnership with Malia Zimmerman, a Fox News reporter, according to the lawsuit, in order to distract public attention from growing concern about investigations into the Trump administration's ties to the Russians. So you have here what Rod Wheeler is alleging is essentially an orchestrated story, not in pursuit of fact, but in pursuit of political and partisan agenda, and one done, as you mentioned, with the knowledge of the White House. And indeed, Sean Spicer, the White House press secretary, confirmed last night to us that he had met on April 20th with Wheeler and with Butowski to talk about it. Spicer said he just did it as a favor to an old friend, Ed Butowski, that he hadn't even known that's what they wanted to talk about. But in terms of the messages that Butowski sent later to Rod Wheeler, he made it clear that he was invoking the White House to pressure him to make good on the story and get it on the air.
What would it mean if these allegations end up being true, that the White House was involved with Fox News on this?
Well, it seriously discredits the enterprise at Fox. Malia Zimmerman is a reporter on the news side. Fox, to be fair to it, did retract that story and said it failed to meet its standards. But nonetheless, it would show the news organization presented as fair and balanced is actually very much in cahoots with a major political figure, in fact, the most powerful in the country. And it would tell you something about the news channel that has perhaps been the most on TV to adopt the phrase of fake news that the president has put out there against any coverage that's inconvenient, and in fact, one, at least in this allegation, that had essentially conjured up a story almost from whole cloth. And that's what we're going to see as this lawsuit plays out, whether those allegations hold up.
David, just about 30 seconds left here, but you spoke with the family of Seth Rich today. What did they say?
Well, they were very restrained, clearly pained, tearful in our conversation earlier today, declining to point the finger directly at Butowski for any personal criticism. But they said that the story that appeared on Fox, ultimately retracted, that claimed that their son had been involved in those leaks and that he'd been killed perhaps as part of some sort of partisan cover-up, they said that was as wrenching as the day that their son died.
That's NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik, who is working very hard on this story that he broke today. David, thank you.
You bet.
We love lakes. And as we've been spending some time considering lakes this summer, we've debated the best in the country, the efforts to preserve them. We've been taken by how important they are to you as well.
Lake Michigan looks different every single day. Last week, sunbeams were streaming down onto water the color of beach glass, giving the effect of sparkling jewels.
Being on the lake makes me the happiest person in the world. Our lives can become so hectic, but at the lake, time really does stand still.
Ashley Van Treese of New York City, before her Mary McIlvain of Racine, Wisconsin. Lakes remind Americans how much we have in common. We spoke with the Ewing family. They've been going to the same humble lake cottage on Newman Lake in Washington State for over 80 years. Then we heard from listener Erica Edmondson from Jackson Hole, Wyoming. She's been going there, too.
Our family has also been on Newman Lake since the early 1900s. My great-great-grandfather, Jack Rayome, started coming to the lake in 1915 and bought our cabin in 1922. I'm the fifth generation, and I don't know the Ewings myself, but I'm sure my great-grandparents did.
So let's go once more to the lake, which is also the title of the classic essay by E.B. White, he of Charlotte's Web fame. Harper's Magazine first published it in 1941. In it, he reflects on taking his son to the lake where he spent his childhood. They get bait and a boat, pretty simple. Then, well, here's a line read by our colleague George Hicks.
Summertime. Oh, summertime. Pattern of life indelible. The fade-proof lake. The woods unshatterable. The pasture with the sweet fern and the juniper forever and ever, summer without end.
But then, into that summer without end, a thunderstorm. This was the big scene, E.B. White writes, a curious darkening of the sky. Then the kettle drum, the snare, the bass and cymbals. Gods grinning and licking their chops. Today we're talking lakes and literature with Tilar Matseo, author and professor of English at Colby College in Waterville, Maine. Professor, you tell us there's actually sort of a lake genre?
Absolutely. In fact, that lake in Maine is very, that you're talking about with the E.B. White, is the Belgrade Lakes, which is the Lake District of Maine, which is very near to Colby College. But there's also, of course, the Lake District in Britain that preceded that and that was very famous for the Lake School poets.
Okay, so we're going to talk about that. But Belgrade Lake, this is, again, the unnamed lake in White's essay. A listener reminded us of this piece. He said he first read it in college 30 years ago. It's a staple of freshman composition classes. Why? What's so special about it?
Well, and I teach it every year when I teach freshman comp. It's one of my favorite essays. And part of it is that he's had a huge impact on what we consider American prose style, which is this very clear, kind of crystalline prose style.
Let's listen to a bit more.
I guess I remembered clearest of all the early mornings when the lake was cool and motionless, remembered how the bedroom smelled of the lumber it was made of, and of the wet woods whose scent entered through the screen.
So one of the reasons that it's so commonly taught is it's an incredibly beautiful piece of writing. But for me, one of the things I also like about it is as a personal essay, I always say to students that I think in some ways to understand that essay, you need to remember the moment at which it was published. It was published in 1941, in the fall of 41, right before Pearl Harbor and America's entry into the Second World War. So it's really in some ways a rumination about trying to get outside of an oncoming political storm by thinking about what it means to retreat to a lake and be outside of that for a moment.
Without ever making the direct connection to what was going on. But before that, he talks about the dragonfly that lights on his rod and the outboard motors. There were just inboard motors, you know, when he'd been on the lake years ago and how they buzz around like flies too. And how he would have this weird sensation when he did something with his son that it was his father doing it.
Right, absolutely. There is a lot of productive confusion in that essay about looking at his son and feeling as though he's inhabiting his son's body or that his son is inhabiting his body. And that the sense of the physical way in which we pass history on to our children, and how going to a lake in the summer in Maine, doing the same thing that your father did and having your children do the same thing is a kind of continuity of a certain kind of American experience for E.B. White.
Well, and he came up with a line that we've been using in the past month to talk about lakes, you know, describing the little camps and the paths and the outhouses and the can of lime for sprinkling around the outhouse, the souvenir counters, the birch bark canoes, the postcards that showed things a little better than they actually looked, you know, because we're not talking about McMansions on the lake here. We're talking about just small places to escape. He wrote, "This was the American family at play, escaping the city heat." But the American family at play.
Yeah. I mean, in some ways, I think it's what we're all trying to recreate on the 4th of July. It's that vision of the lake that I think E.B. White had, you know, that you have the red and white checkered tablecloth and you have the roast chicken and you go and buy the blueberries at the farm stand and you go for the swim in the lake and the, you know, the kids lie on the dock for the afternoon. And I think for him, even in that moment, he was looking back to this idea of a simpler history. Because, of course, 1941 was not a simple moment in the world either. You're absolutely right. I mean, there were no McMansions on the lake. I actually grew up on a lake in Maine and remember those old cottages, which I think have now tumbled down. You know, just the little cottages with the screened windows and, as you say, the outhouses. But I think even for White, that was already a nostalgic moment, an idea that there was this passing of a simpler moment. And that the 20th century was a complicated place to live.
Yeah. Okay, well, let's talk about the lake poets briefly across the pond in Britain, inspired by lakes. William Wordsworth, Samuel Taylor Coleridge, Robert Southey, the lake poets.
Right. So these were what were known as the British Romantics, poets that were living at the end of the 18th century and the beginning of the 19th century, which was also a complicated moment to be alive. That was the beginning in some ways in Britain of the Industrial Revolution, and they were really watching in Britain the end of certain kinds of pastoral agricultural landscapes. And these are a bunch of poets who retreated to the Lake District, which was still a very remote landscape at that moment. And Dorothy Wordsworth was the sister of William Wordsworth. She kept a very detailed naturalist journal, commonly available to everybody in the households, and was used as a kind of inspiration for a lot of the poetry that was written about the lakes and the mountains as well in that area.
Here's something she wrote. I walked along the lakeside. The air was become still. The lake was of a bright slate color, the hills darkening, the bay shot into the low fading shores, sheep resting, all things quiet. And, of course, the poem that you think, oh, I'm not going to know this poem. Yeah, you are. It's Daffodils, William Wordsworth. We're going to have our colleague George just read the beginning of that.
I wandered lonely as a cloud that floats on high o'er vales and hills, when all at once I saw a crowd, a host of golden daffodils, beside the lake, beneath the trees, fluttering and dancing in the breeze.
A crowd of daffodils. They are a crowd. But they weren't, I mean, they were so inspired by the lake and by nature. This is, you call them the Romantics. This is their way of, what, getting out of motion?
Yeah, it was really a reaction in some ways against the Industrial Revolution and against this heightened urbanism that was beginning to take over in England and beginning to change that culture. So it was a moment of huge economic transformation in Britain. And on the one hand, they wanted to be part of the political transformation that came with that. They were ardent supporters of the American Revolution and the French Revolution and, you know, really wanted a different vision of England that was not what was, you know, the Industrial Revolution was consolidating class differences and not opening that space up. So they wanted to be part of this political idealistic vision. But at the same time, they wanted to step outside of the economic pressures of industrialization that were bringing it to a point of crisis.
Wow. You know, I'm thinking this is heavy. You know, lakes as a way to talk about the Industrial Revolution, before that, World War II. We've heard about so many lake and literature connections. Mary Shelley wrote Frankenstein on the shores of Lake Geneva, Switzerland, in 1816. We spoke to an author about that summer after a volcanic eruption. We'll link you to that story at herenow.org. Listeners wrote us about Thoreau's Walden, which is technically a kettle pond, but Lisa Bohr tweeted his quote, "A lake is a landscape's most beautiful and expressive feature. It is Earth's eye." Many listeners mentioned Lake Wobegon people. Garrison Keillor made that one up. But we'd still love to hear your lake and literature connections at hereandnow.org. As we thank Tilar Matteo, author and professor of English at Colby College in Waterville, Maine. Tilar, thank you so much.
Thank you.
We're hearing more calls for the Trump administration to fire Richard Cordray, head of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. Here's President Trump's former campaign manager, Corey Lewandowski, speaking with NBC's Meet the Press on Sunday.
I think the general should relook at firing Richard Cordray, the CFPB. He's a person who is now all but running for governor in the state of Ohio, and he's sitting in federal office right now.
The general he's referring to is John Kelly, President Trump's new chief of staff. And joining us now is NPR correspondent Chris Arnold. Hi, Chris.
Hey, Jeremy.
And before we get to the question of whether Cordray is going to be fired, let's talk about what this agency has been doing. It's been doing a lot, and it's a new agency. Remind us what the CFPB is.
Right. So the financial crisis struck in 2008, and a big part of that was big financial firms doing incredibly reckless things that, you know, flew the plane into the mountain, basically, with the economy. And we suffered the worst recession since the Great Depression. So in response, Congress created the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. And on their website, they describe what they do as, quote, "We protect consumers from unfair, deceptive, or abusive practices and take action against companies that break the law." And it turns out that sounds pretty good to most Americans. One poll earlier this year found that Trump voters, want the Bureau left alone or strengthened by a 2-to-1 margin. So it turns out this is a pretty popular Bureau.
And what it's actually been doing includes a new rule on class action lawsuits involving banks and credit card companies. What does that entail?
Right. Consumer advocates say this is great because what it does is it says a big financial firm can no longer, in the fine print when you get a credit card or something, somewhere in there it says, I promise not to sue the bank. You know, and what the rule says is you can't just put in a few words like that and then disqualify the person from joining a class action lawsuit when, say, potentially millions of people have been harmed. So very popular among lawyers and consumer advocates, very unpopular among big banks and financial firms, and they've been lobbying against this rule, and Congress is taking steps to try to overturn it.
The CFPB has also finalized its mortgage disclosure rule to provide more protections for homeowners, but maybe the bigger deal recently was something it did to protect consumers who have taken out student loans.
Right. And there's so many people with student loans in this country. And what a lot of people really don't understand is that if you have a federal student loan, there are a bunch of protections so that if you're between jobs or you don't have enough money, you can't pay for a while, your loan terms can be modified. You can get a lower payments, no payments at all for a time, a kind of the interest cost that you're paying. The problem is, though, you don't call the government. You call a private company that manages these federal loans. And what happens is, according to the CFPB, they've been doing a terrible job of connecting people to these, you know, these options that are out there. So instead, people get kind of bogus repayment plans where the debt spirals out of control and they end up paying more and more and more. The CFPB recently sued the biggest servicing company, as they're called, Navient, and said it was, quote, illegally cheating many struggling borrowers and causing them to pay much more than they had to. So, again, the CFPB is trying to crack down and force the industry to do a better job.
All right. So they're doing a lot. So let's get to the politics of this and the calls for Richard Cordray to go. This is not new. In fact, here's Republican Congressman Jeb Hensarling of Texas who brought this up back in April when discussing the CFPB.
The CFPB has acted unlawfully. Richard Cordray should be dismissed by the president.
Cordray also has his supporters. Here's Democratic Congresswoman Maxine Waters of California.
I am delighted that you are here. I am so honored that you have done the work that you have done despite unyielding Republican efforts to impede your work.
How did this get so partisan, Chris?
Well, these twice-a-year reports to Congress, they really have become partisan to the point of political theater. I mean, I have not – this is just the most over-the-top, hyperbolic sort of, you know, regular hearings. I mean, I just haven't ever seen anything like this. You know, Republicans go down the line. They berate Cordray. He often doesn't have time to really answer. One of them in that hearing said the CFPB was a rotting agency. And basically, they say Cordray is a villain and the CFPB is ruining America. And the Democrats line up and say, no, 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 Cordray is the savior of the American people. And this actually still sticks in my head from when from that particular hearing. Maxine Waters, the Democrat who we just heard, said, Director Cordray, I will be with you forever in like dramatic fashion, like she's pledging allegiance to the king of consumer protection. Democrats love this guy in the agency. Republicans, the opposite.
And Republicans control Congress and the White House right now. But it's not quite as easy to fire Richard Cordray as it sounds, right?
Right. The president's been urged to do that. We heard that at the beginning. But it's unclear if he legally has the power to do that. So there would be a huge court case if he tried to go that route. Hard to predict what the administration will try to do, but seems unlikely.
If Congress or Trump is able to get rid of Cordray, does the CFPB have any future at that point?
It's hard to predict, but look, the optics here would be really bad. What we're talking about, firing the head of a popular agency that protects consumers from Wall Street.
Right.
Congress could pass a law, but so far the calculation seems to be that, look, Cordray's term expires in July of 2018. Let's just wait. He'll leave and Republicans will go from there.
That's NPR correspondent Chris Arnold. Chris, thanks so much.
Happy to do it.
And Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here Now.